to get you some exercise in the morning. Just hand waving. I'm going to start on a bit of a low note this morning, unfortunately, but then we're going to get stuck right back into it. If anyone was concerned about behavior at the party last night, please come and see me straight after. Thanks. Good morning, freedom lovers! Benno, can you check if anyone else is still outside the door? Because good morning, freedom lovers! Oh, okay, so we didn't have too many people left out given last night's festivities. Drink water, particularly today. I want to thank Google for the party last night. It was really awesome. Apparently, there were about 100 photos taken of the till, which had the bar tab registered on it the entire night. So perhaps we might do an animated slideshow of the till as it went off. Wish we also took photos of someone's face as that till went off. That might have been indicative. The potent aura of fertility has struck the LCA ghost crowd again. A couple of days ago, Michael Davies, organizer of 2004 in Adelaide, and his wife had a new child, Nathaniel. There are pictures available on his website and so on if you're interested. It is very cute. Also, the new Linux Australia committee was announced yesterday at the Linux Australia AGM. Do we have all the LA folks? I know they're hard drinkers, but I'm sure they're here this morning. If you could stand up. AJ, you can stand up. I know you can. Rock and roll. These are the poor suckers who are going to have to deal with the Melbourne team throughout the next year. So, they do wonderful work, and they have a hard year ahead of them. I want to spread the love a little bit this morning. I forgot to do something very important yesterday morning. Mr. Chris Blizzard, are you in here? No. Sneezing? No? Oh, Chris, please come on up. Come on up. Unfortunately, we didn't get a recording of your talk yesterday morning, so if you'd like to grab your laptop and do it again. For no, come for you. We have some special gifts for you. LinuxConf AU 2007 schooner glasses. Please do the translation for the interstates and the internationals. Thanks very much. You put beer in it, basically. Thank you. I've also been told a couple of times in the last couple of days that the 17 has been so focused on making an awesome conference for you guys that we've actually forgot to introduce ourselves, apparently. A couple of people come up and said, "Hi, I'm Joe." I'm like, "Hi, I'm Jeff." And they're like, "Oh, now I know. Thanks, bye." So this is the 17. You have John Folito, who's doing all of our crazy network stuff. Lindsay Homewood, who's our speaker liaison and scribe. Sarah Khan, who's been doing all the fantastic catering and event stuff. Ben Leslie, who's been doing front of house, and he's the person running around very, very stressed, making sure everything works in the venue. Pia Waugh, who's been working with all of our media people. Me, for some reason, the only person who's not wearing black in this photo. I think it has to do with me being the person who got to choose the photos. I like this shirt, man. It's a good shirt. Do you like this? I like this shirt. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. My name is Jeff Waugh. I've washed it every night. I can't tell Eric to shut up because he's actually a speaker. Finally, Jamie Wilkinson, who has been the person most frustrated on the registration desk. He's also the guy who built our website and has been doing treasury. So somehow Jamie got all the bad jobs. Thank you, Jamie. I also want to send a shout out to our paper review team. Today is the first day of the main conference program, and it's a result of all of their hard work that we have fantastic speakers for you. If you guys could stand up. Eric, Peter, Robert, Glenn, Mary, Angus, Michael, Andre, Conrad, Sylvia, Martin, and Rusty. They braved the 300. Don't throw anything at them, especially not sunscreen. Thank you. They braved the 300 proposals that came in and whittled them down to the amazingly awesome 84 that we have for you in the next couple of days. And because we've got such awesome talks and because you had such a hard time choosing between all of them, we had to make absolutely sure that our AV efforts were awesome this year. So could the audio and video team please stand up? They're doing an awesome job, and we've managed to optimize software out of the process completely. Those videos will start being uploaded today now that we're going to have fast network to upload them. On that point, speed and coverage. We've changed part of the networking, so there's now much faster. As a result of some complaints last night on IRC during the party, that World of Warcraft wasn't working. So we now have awesome coverage as well. We have lots of coverage in the various colleges, except Warraine. My apologies to the Warraine people. We weren't able to figure out network there. What you'll have to do is go towards the common areas as much as possible. I believe Steve Walsh also can be used as an access point. Where's Steve? Is he wearing his hat? Someone took Steve Walsh's hat. Steve has an X mutation that allows him to be used as a wireless access point repeater, which as a geek superpower I think is pretty awesome. So. So if you're looking for wireless, follow Steve. He knows where it is. Lost and found. We have a bunch of stuff in Lost and Found at the Rego desk. In particular, last night, a little packet was found that appears to be of use to a diabetic, so you'll be wanting that soon, especially after last night. Power network. Please be very, 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 very careful of power network cables, particularly the ones behind cameras. Unfortunately, we actually lost a couple of videos yesterday because someone thought their laptop was more important than our camera. I love your laptop. I love your data. I love it when you get your email. People will cry when they don't get their talks recorded, so please be extremely careful about that. What we've got lined up for you today is really, really awesome. We have the full conference program in action. At afternoon tea, what we've tried to do this year is help some of the smaller local sponsors, smaller local companies sponsor the conference and have some exposure. BabelCom will be around at afternoon tea on the east wing of the pavilions, so go over there and have a chat to Dell at BabelCom. Dell has very kindly given his morning tea to OSIA, the Open Source Industry Australia. They're the industry counterpart to Linux Australia. If you want to know anything about them, again, the east wing of the pavilion. Later on tonight, for professional delegates only, sorry everyone else, but I believe there's a pizza party being arranged on the attendees mailing list. Go to the professional delegates networking session at the Scientia. It's marked on your map. There is actually going to be quite a lot of food there. You probably won't need dinner. We've got heaps of food this year. You may need a taxi. Special announcement, we have a special hacking competition over the next couple of days that we're going to be judging sometime early Friday morning and performing on at the closing ceremony on Friday afternoon. If you're interested in doing game development, CSE, the Science of Computer Science, the School of Computer Science and Engineering, are doing some input device research. and we have the opportunity to create a game using this input device. Very, very cool. You'll find on the wiki input device game test page. There's some scant details about the protocol there. It should be pretty clear. If there's any queries about it, please just add your queries to the wiki page. Basically, all you'll have to do is write a little program, connects to a server that provides the data for you from the input device. It's pretty well described on that wiki page. There will be a server up, and we'll mention that on the wiki page soon, a test server that you'll be able to test data coming in. Basically, what it is, it's a one-axis input device. It's very, very early stage. We've only got one axis at this point. And you can create a game for us. So you might want to do something like Frogger, say, or something like that. But have a look at the wiki page, come up with something cool, and we'll be judging those on Friday morning. Again, drink water. You're going to feel much better at the end of the day if you drink water. We're going to have new water deliveries this morning. So enjoy your LinuxConf AU. Now I have the great pleasure to introduce someone very important to our community. If this person hadn't written a certain kernel, many of us wouldn't be here today. Some of us would. Many of us wouldn't. He's an educator. He has a shining wit. He's an awesome dude, and I'd like to invite on stage Linus Torvald.
Okay, you already all know who I am going to introduce, and it's a great pleasure to introduce Andy Tannenbaum. The one thing I wanted to talk about, since I have universally gotten one reaction about this thing that I'm introducing Andy, and it's incredulity and questions of, isn't that a bit awkward? Because it turns out that if you actually Google for Torvalds and Tannenbaum, the only thing you will find is our disagreements, right? But the fact is that in many ways, Andy has been very much a big part of the history of Linux, because before I even started Linux, this is not the book, but this is the book that came after the book that introduced me to Unix and also made me believe that writing your own operating system isn't actually that hard. It turns out that it wasn't true, but I'd like to introduce Andy Tannenbaum as a very integral part to why Linux exists in the first place. And even though people may be aware of the differences, you should maybe be aware of the similarities are much, much greater. So, Andy, please.
Wait, you haven't heard the talk yet. I'd like to put to rest a rumor that we saw on Flashdot after one of the many events there that Linus and I had a fight over a woman in West Virginia. Not true. Okay, thank you very much for inviting me here. And I'm going to fight fire with fire. You know. No, I'm not going to fight fire with fire. Okay. I want to talk about reliable operating systems. Sometimes it doesn't exist, but you know, in some mythical world in the future, we might have them. As you might expect, the one in the middle, the graduate student, did all the work. But that's the way things are in academia. I want to start out talking with Myhrvold's laws. Nathan Myhrvold was a former executive at Microsoft, and he formulated some laws which I think are quite relevant. Software is a gas. It expands to fill its container. You know, Back on the PDP-11, when we had 4K of memory, all the programs were 4K. Then when the VAX came out and we had a megabyte of memory, all the programs were a megabyte. Now that we have a gigabyte of memory, all the programs are a gigabyte. And in 10 years, all the programs will be a terabyte. He also said, software is getting slower faster than hardware is getting faster. You know what I mean. My old PDP-11, which ran at 1 megahertz, booted in 5 seconds, okay? My Core 2, 2.93 gigahertz X6800 PC, which is the fastest machine Intel ever made in its entire history, takes 2 minutes to boot, okay? So the machine is probably at least 5,000 times faster than the PDP-11 and has 1/20th the performance. What's wrong with this picture? Here's what's wrong with this picture. Software bloat, my favorite topic. You're going to hear a lot about that in the next hour. It's hard to get your hands and your head around what lines of code mean. So imagine you take code and you print it in book form with 50 lines per page, like a book normally has, 800 pages, kind of thick book, 25 to a bookshelf, okay? So that gives you some metric for code size and something you can vision. Windows NT 3.1, 1993, was 6 million lines of code. What does 6 million lines of code mean? Well, you put it in book form, which fill up an entire bookcase this wide and this high, and then a little bit more, okay? Windows NT 3.5 in 1994 was 10 million lines of code. That's two bookcases. Windows NT 4 in 1996 was 16 million lines of code. That's three bookcases and a bit more. Windows 2000 was 29 million lines of code. That's five bookcases. And Windows XP is 50 million lines of code, 10 bookcases. Now imagine you're a new hire at Microsoft working on the kernel team, and they said, okay, here, go to this room with those 10 bookcases, go learn that stuff, okay? And they come back a week later and say, okay, hopefully you've learned it, now let's start hacking. The reality is there's nobody who understands how XP works. Not Bill Gates, not Dave Cutler who wrote it, not anybody. Okay? And when you've got a system where nobody understands it, nobody understands the interactions between the pieces, that's not a good thing. I often notice with Windows that I'm trying to do something and nothing happens because it's busy doing something else it wants in the background. And I've had arguments with people at Microsoft saying, why don't you just change the scheduler, give the foreground job half the CPU, and run the rest of them around robin? And the answer was, nobody understands how the schedule works. We don't dare touch it. We break everything. We just can't touch it. Probably not a good idea. Now, how does that translate to the real world? I have a cousin. She's a real sweetie. I walk in, she says, hi, how you doing? My computer's broken. You know what's going to happen now. You're a computer genius, which is not true, but I don't want to disillusion her. I like her. So, you know. Please fix it. So I'm Mr. Fix It. I'm sure all of you have the same experience. You go to your cousin or your non-tech friend, my computer doesn't work, fix it. Of course, I didn't think of that line. It was a guy with much more hair. Besides, I'm not a physicist. He's not anymore. But I don't know how to indicate genius in computer terms, 1010. I think maybe P equals NP might, I'd probably cross the P's out and conclude N equals 1. But what I'm thinking is, it's Windows. Okay, New York Times, July 17, 2005, had the following story leading on the business page. On a recent Sunday morning, when Lou Tucker's Dell desktop computer was overrun by spyware and adware, stealth software that delivers intrusive advertising messages and even gathers data from the user's machine, he did not simply get rid of the offending programs. He threw out the whole computer. And Lou Tucker is a PhD in computer science. if guys with PhDs in computer science can't manage this, so he went on to give more examples and so on. It's nice that my family isn't weird, but, people with PhDs in computer science can't manage the PC. I think there's a problem. I would like to introduce what I think of as the television model. This is the way the television model goes. You buy the television, that's step one. Step two, you plug in the television. Step three, it works perfectly for the next 10 years. That's the way televisions work, okay? People are used to that model. Now we're gonna look at the computer model. You buy the computer. You plug it in, unless it's a laptop. So far it's the same, okay? But it's that it works perfectly for the next 10 years part where it begins to differ a little bit. First you install Service Pack 1 through 9F. Then you install 18 new emergency security patches later than 9F. Then you find and install 7 new device drivers, which they didn't bother to include. Then you install the antivirus software. Then you install the anti-spyware software. Then you install the anti-hacker software. Then you install the anti-spam software. Then you reboot the computer. We're not done yet, but I ran out of space on the slide. It doesn't work. You call the help desk. You wait on hold for 30 minutes. They tell you to reinstall Windows. What's the typical user reaction to this? The New York Times recently reported that 25% of computer users have gotten so angry at the computer, they physically hit it. You're going to hit your car, hit your stereo. I mean, you know, things are not perfect. So my interest and focus has been on reliable operating systems. So I'm going to give a definition now of what I consider a reliable operating system. I may be sorry about this someday, but so be it. An operating system is said to be reliable when a typical heavy user has never experienced a failure, even a single failure, in his or her lifetime, and does not know anyone who's ever experienced a failure. That's my idea of reliable. It just works all the time. Okay? So I want to introduce a metric for measuring that. And my metric is lifetime failures, which I'll call LF, number of times it's failed in your lifetime. Birders, you know, bird watchers, they keep life lists of the number of different bird species they've seen, okay? So, you know, here's somebody who's got, you know, 604 birds and an owl, that's a new one, and so on. And so I have a life list of software failures. For my television, never fail, the software, TV's full of software. I know people at Philips, and they say, when you look at a TV, you think hardware. When I look at a TV, I think software. You know, it's got 40 megabytes of code in there, and it's very complicated. And, you know, they have a problem when people buy just one of these, you know, 8-foot long, you know, 12-foot high, $3,000 TVs, and it fails. It gives them a blue screen. Customers don't like it unless they're looking at the sky. And, but TVs don't normally fail. My stereo is full of software. Never fails. Zero. My cell phone, you know, it's full of software. Never fails. My DVD player. Your cell phone has failed? Oh, God. my car, fortunately, is software's never failed, you know. What about my computer? Oh, shit. Press any key to continue. All right, let's all cross our fingers collectively and see what happens there. Oh. So, is software reliability important? I said, don't ask your office mate, probably a nerd. Ask your grandma. Turns out grandmas have a different view of the world than office mates. You know, grandmas just think it should work all the time. And it's kind of a different thing than tech people. I think a lot of people would learn a lot by talking to sort of non-tech people and getting their input on what's important. And it turns out that while your office mate thinks that, you know, affinity scheduling algorithms for clusters of quad-core systems are really, really neat, grandma doesn't think so. Grandma just wants it to work all the time. And so anyway, The real users basically just want the thing to work all the time. So is Linux more reliable than Windows? Interesting philosophical question here. Again, going to the New York Times, I saw, I guess it was on December 20th on Christmas. There was no other news, I guess, so they ran this story. John Markov, I know, wrote this. Markov wrote, Microsoft is facing an early crisis in confidence in the quality of its Windows Vista operating system, as computer security researchers and hackers have begun to find potentially serious flaws in the system. So I know Markov, so I said, what's up? And he says, it's full of buffer overflows and all the usual stuff is still there. You know, they haven't learned anything. And are they ever going to improve it? Probably not, because it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I don't know how big it is now. I mean, XP is 50 million lines of code. This is probably 100 million lines of code. If you haven't tried Vista yet, it's got all kinds of nifty features, like on regular web pages, normally there's like a button for, you know, I don't know, open or submit or close. In Vista, you can put movies on those buttons. You know, so you can have a whole screen with 8 movies playing on the various buttons at the same time, competing for the audio. That's, you know, like people really want this. But, and in return, it crashes much more often, and it's got more security problems. So it seems to me some people's priorities aren't, you know, entirely in the right place. But okay, is Linux more reliable than Windows? My guess is, and I, you know, it's hard to do real experiments, yes, probably, because the kernel is smaller, okay? And there have been a lot of studies on bugs in software. You know, people here just sort of hack, but those of you who are professionals probably know that in your organization they have, you know, a systematic way of keeping track of bugs, and they log them, and they try to fix them, and, you know, they know about that. They use software engineering practices. And people have studied, you know, known bugs over time and as a function of code size and as a function of module size. There's been a number of studies. I've got a couple of footnotes in here at the end. But typical studies show that there are something like 10 to 75 bugs per 1,000 lines of code across many, many systems. That's sort of the way things are. I mean, you know, like, you know, one bug per 100 lines is considered pretty good. I suppose Linux is 10 times better than other software, which is asking a lot, but, you know, people say, well, a lot of people look at the code and, you know, find the bugs, blah, blah, blah. It's possible. Take for granted that it's 10 times better than what Oracle and everybody else can do, okay? So I think it's stretching it a little bit, but let's take that as an assumption here. Dawson Engler's group at Stanford University studied Linux, and they have tools for looking for certain kinds of bugs. For example, if you lock a data structure, you better unlock it. You know, if you lock a data structure and there's an if statement and you unlock it on the if path, but you don't unlock it on the else path, probably that's a bug, because if you take the else path, it's never going to get unlocked. Okay? So they mechanically went out looking for bugs in Linux, especially in drivers, and they discovered that the drivers are typically 3 to 7 times more buggy than regular code. And that's because the core code is written by, you know, Linux and people who know what they're doing, and the drivers are written by people who work for some manufacturer, you know, somewhere in Asia, and they're in a big hurry to get the product out. And, you know, they don't care about whether it works or not. And so they're just buggier. It's just, you know, an observation, a measurement. And typically drivers are something like 70% of the code. Of course, it varies depending on configurations and whatnot. So I did a little bit of arithmetic here. If you got one bug per 1,000 lines of code, which again is 10 times better than anybody else can do, and there are 5 times as many bugs in the drivers as everything else, and you got, say, 3 million lines of code roughly, and 70% are drivers, that means that the Linux kernel probably has over 10,000 bugs in it. Okay? Now, they're not all fatal, of course. Some of them are, you know, it made an error in printing something, or it was a typo in some screen message or something like that. So they're not all fatal. But anything with 10,000 bugs in it, you know, it's not a good thing. Right? I mean, you really don't want to have that class of bugs. In Windows, you know, I dare not think. This is assuming that Linux code is 10 times better than anybody else's code. In Windows, probably there's 100,000 bugs, you know, in the same amount of code, and they got more codes, so probably there's 200,000 bugs. That's a lot of bugs. You know, it's really very difficult to make reliable systems when there's so much stuff in there. Sorry, a couple of footnotes here, but if you, you know, look in the literature, you'll find people who've studied bugs per 1,000 lines of code and written papers on the subject. It's well understood. So the question is reliability achievable at all? Okay, if you got one bug every 100 lines of code normally and one bug every 1,000 lines of code in open source code because more people have looked at it, can you ever make anything reliable? Well, actually, there are systems that can survive hardware failures. If you can survive a hardware failure, surely you can survive a software failure. For example, a RAID can survive a failed disk. The disk dies, and the RAID continues because they built in redundancy and so on, and the other drives can take over. If a memory fails, if there are ECC memories, error correcting codes, which have parity errors and Hamming codes and so on, and they can survive hardware, you know, memory failures, a memory word has gone bad, they can survive that. TCP, as you know, can survive lost packets. Packet just, you know, goes off to outer Mongolia somewhere, and the connection works fine because TCP, you know, times out and retransmissions and so on. You can survive network failures. CD-ROMs, I don't know if you know how that works. A CD-ROM, 3/4 of the bits are error-correcting bits on a CD. They stamp them, WAP, and it's just very unreliable process. There's lots and lots of errors. But there's 3 levels of error correction on a CD. There's 14 bits to encode an 8-bit number, and then there's, you know, 6,000 bytes to encode a 2,000-byte sector, and it's full of error correcting. So that works. If you can survive hardware failures, surely we can survive software failures. So I think my pitch is we need to make software that can survive failures in the software. If you can survive hardware failures, software's got to be, you know, real easy. Okay? I think we'll be done when no computer has a reset button. And my computer's got a reset button on the front. Okay? My car doesn't have a reset button. You know, reset software. You know, go download new software from the manufacturer. It doesn't have one. You know, the manufacturer was not expecting it to fail. My TV doesn't have a reset button. It may well be that in the future they do, but I don't think that's a good development. Okay? So I think if we can survive hardware failures, we ought to try to make software which can survive software failures. So how are we going to do this? I think it's time to rethink operating systems. I mean, the reality is that Linux is sort of, you know, a better version of Multics, which dates from 1965, and Windows is a better version of MS-DOS, which dates from, you know, I don't know, 1979 or so. We have to sort of refocus and rethink where we're going, you know, 2007. We have infinite hardware. You know, I got a machine now, even this little thing is still, you know, what, 2,000 times faster than my PDP-11. And my PDP-11 worked fine. I had no problems with the PDP-11, except when we had 25 users on it with our 2.5 megabyte disk, you know, and 16K of memory, but it still worked. And we have basically infinite hardware. You know, performance isn't really an issue except in niche applications like big web servers and things. But there's basically infinite hardware, and the only reason it's slow is because the software's so bad. There's lots of CPU cycles, there's, you know, gigabyte of RAM, tons of bandwidth. We're just not resource starved as we were back in the days of, remember there was a system here, I think it was University of New South Wales, there was a VAX that had 80 users on it, you know, 1 megabyte, you know, 1 MIPS VAX with, you know, maybe a 40 megabyte disk that ran 80 users. And it sort of worked. And we've got just infinite hardware now. So performance, you know, for the most part, just isn't an issue. It's a bad focus. But the problem is that software's got tons of, I would say, useless features. You know, version 3 of any package sort of has got the major bugs out of it. Then the manufacturer of the software says, oh, gee, to sell upgrades, we have to think of new features. So, you know, in Word, they put in a way you can hyperlink. So when you print out a document, if you bang on it with your hand, it brings up a new web page. You know, hello, Word is for printed documents. You don't need hyperlinks in them, but it hasn't occurred to them, you know. And so they add more and more features. It gets more and more bloated. It gets less and less reliable. I think it's a bad direction to go into. As a result of all this stuff, the software is sort of bloated and slow and buggy, and it's a bad direction. And so to achieve the TV model, you know, or LF equals zero, however you want to express it, high reliability, I think systems have to be small. We want to minimize the code in the kernel, because kernel code, you know, if that goes bad, you know, you're sunk. Modular is very important. You know, remember Software Engineering 101 class talked about modularity and interfaces and stuff. Self-healing, I think, is extremely important. You know, things that die should be fixable on the fly. Like a RAID, you know, while it's running, if a drive fails, it can fix itself. You know, ECC memories correct themselves on the fly. Why can't software correct itself on the fly? Correcting bad software on the fly surely is easier than correcting bad hardware on the fly, and that's possible. So I think we need to go in the direction of self-healing software. You know, in many, like avionics and so on, they have, you know, triple modular redundancy with three of everything, and then there are 3 voters that vote on the 3 of them, and, you know, it's well known how to do some of these things. So maybe this is an opportunity for Linux to become known as, you know, the little system that could or something. I don't know. Here's a data point. Some of you may know I'm actually I'm not really a computer scientist. I'm a political activist. I'm running a website called electoralvote.com, which has been tracking U.S. elections. We're getting 700,000 visitors in 2004, and we got 500,000 in the past election, which is not a random sample of everybody, but it's certainly not selected by their taste in operating systems, selected by their taste in politics to some extent. And the data point I have from the log is that it was 87% Windows, 9% Macintosh, and 4% Linux. And for those who don't know, the Macintosh is basically FreeBSD modified, running on top of the mock kernel, microkernel modified. Linux is about 4%. So I say this is an opportunity for growth. And maybe a direction Linux could go would be the system that's ultra reliable, it works all the time, none of the problems you get with Windows, that might be a direction one could go into. So my advice or whatever. Now onto the intelligent design, popular topic, as applied to operating systems anyway. Here are some principles that I think are very important. Isolate components. You don't want everything talking to everything and, you know, bugs in one thing spread all over the place. You want to isolate them somehow. You want to isolate drivers. You want to isolate file systems. You want to isolate the components so that they're, you know, like firewalls or moats or whatever around the components so problems can't spread. There's a very important principle called the principle of least authority, which says don't give somebody or something more authority than it needs. This is, for example, in the military world, this is a need to know. You know, if you need certain information to do your job, you get that, but they don't give you all the nuclear secrets just because, you know, you're ordering a beer for the platoon. That you have to get that authority you need and no more. That's not true in a lot of systems. You know, everything is authority to do everything. Certainly the failure of one component should not sink the others, because given the fact that, you know, there's probably 10,000 bugs in Linux and maybe 100,000 or more in Windows, you don't want, you know, a failed component, which is going to happen, you know, to be able to sink other components. So you have to be sort of failure tolerant in some sense, isolated, and a failure here doesn't bring down a failure there. The same like in a RAID, if one drive fails, that shouldn't pollute the other drives if things are done properly. You should continuously monitor the health of all the components and see if everybody's happy. You should be prepared to replace components on the fly while it's running. Okay? That's increasingly important even in embedded systems. You know, I've talked with Philips, and you know, they know that their software is so complicated it's going to have errors in it, and since they're connected to a cable network, you know, TVs or satellite network or something, they have the ability sort of silently to replace buggy software on the fly while the thing's running without the users noticing it. Computers are mostly connected to networks too, and it's possible they can fix themselves, you know, or they can fix themselves from the starting component again and so on. So I think being able to sort of fix yourself on the fly is a good thing. So, you know, if our goal is, you know, lifetime failures are zero, how do we go about it? What's the first step? I would say get all the loadable modules out of the kernel. They shouldn't be there. No loadable modules in the kernel. Okay? That includes all the device drivers, all the file systems, everything which is loadable shouldn't be in the kernel. Kernel should be things that have to be in the kernel. You know, the interrupt handler, you sort of can't move that out of the kernel. Okay? Run each module as a separate process with the POLA, principle of least authority. If the file system needs access to certain facilities or resources to do its job, it gets those, but it doesn't get any more. And likewise, the audio driver should have access to the audio, but it shouldn't have access to the printer. It wants to print music for you or something, but you know, assuming it's not doing that, it should have access to what it needs and no more. People are actually starting to do this in a small way with Linux. I saw a couple of papers. Ben Leslie from here and colleagues wrote a paper called User-Level Device Drivers Achieve Performance. They were talking about, you know, how much it costs to do this, and it was published in the Journal of Computer Science and Technology in September. And Peter Chubb wrote a paper called Get More Device Drivers Out of the Kernel. So people are starting to do this with Linux, but I would certainly suggest this be done on a much greater scale, you know, in a bigger way, and, you know, have an architecture which supports this and so on. So it's happening here, starting to happen in a small way, but I think that's a great development, and I certainly encourage it. The second step is isolate the I.O. devices. They're a source of a lot of trouble. Memory mapped I.O., I think, by and large, is a bad idea. You tend to share things between multiple processes. You get race conditions. Probably not a good idea. Limit access to I.O. ports. There's no reason why the audio driver has access to the disk I.O. ports. Okay? In a monolithic kernel, you tend to get that. It's got access to everything. And it means a bug in the audio driver can muck up the disk. It shouldn't do that. It should muck up the audio. You get weird sounds, but that's all. DMA is a problem. Many devices have DMA. You can't do that without hardware assistance because, you know, once you DMA, you can write over memory. But the next generation of hardware is going to have IO MMUs. Some of them already have it. I think the Pacifica has it. And then you can limit, you know, DMA to it from a given process, same way you limit memory access via the IO MMU. So that's a very good step. The hardware guys have figured this out finally. And the next generation of software should make sure that a driver can only touch the things it should be touching, only touch the memory it should be touching. The third step toward LF equals zero is limit inter-process communication. So you get a lot of processes. You don't want them all talking to each other. If some process has a need to talk to some other process, then it needs a way to do it. If it doesn't have a need to do it, you know, it shouldn't be doing it. Restrict kernel calls. If you have a certain number of kernel calls available, you know, for example, if the audio driver doesn't need to do fork or whatever the primitive is for fork, it shouldn't have access to it. It shouldn't be able to do fork. So, you know, limit the power of every component to do only those things it needs to do its job. Ditto IPC, no inter-process communication between components that have no need to talk to each other. So you have to closely regulate that, okay? Another thing which we've had a lot of trouble with is if somebody sends a message to somebody else and somebody else isn't listening or doesn't respond, that can hang the sender. You have to be a little bit careful how you do that. It's trickier than it looks at first, okay? So enough of theory. I've told you how to do it now. The question you might ask is, well, can it be done? Can you actually build a system based on these principles? And I think it can be. Remember Minix? Actually, none of you did because none of you were born then. But it was released in 1987, a long time ago. And everybody was bugging me to add more features. I need this and I need that. I need it before Friday. And, you know, and I was sitting there kind of trying to keep it real simple, waiting for the Messiah to arrive. He was promising GNU would solve all of your problems, and I'm still on the edge of my chair waiting. Maybe someday it will solve all my problems. Meanwhile, I went out and went my own direction. So we built this thing called Minix, and then we've changed it about a year and a bit ago. Basically, a major redesign for very high reliability. I was tempted to change the name also, because, you know, it has a certain amount of, you know, baggage with the name. But my friends in marketing said, you have a famous brand name, don't throw it away. And so, you know, I added a number to it. It's like the Windows, you know, 3.1 and Windows XP or Windows Vista have nothing to do with each other at all. They're unrelated systems. But Microsoft's marketing guy said, we have a famous brand name, keep it. They add a little thing on the end. So, okay. 3.1.2, which is in your conference bag, doesn't have all the reliability features I'm going to talk about now, but it's got most of them. We have the rest of them running in the lab. But I'm one of these nervous Nellies who doesn't like to distribute software to 800 people until we've really tested it pretty thoroughly. So hopefully by March or so, we'll have 3.1.3, which will have pretty much all these things. You can get it from the website later. Anyway, so here's the architectural design. Basically, there's this little kernel at the very bottom, about 3,800 lines of code currently. It handles interrupts, which you pretty much have to do in the kernel. It handles a very primitive notion of a process, because it knows it's going to run somebody. There's a scheduler, so the scheduler says, okay, run him, and it knows the mechanism, but not the policy for running things. So the scheduler says, go run him, and he knows it'll load the registers and, you know, set the MMU up and so on. And there's inter-process communication. And there's a little bit of checking to make sure people don't do bad things. And I'll mention that in a minute. And the clock is in the kernel, too. It's an I.O. driver. But the clock is so intimately related to scheduling that it could have been put in user space. It would have been a bad idea. And the sys thing handles kernel calls. It's not really a driver, but there are calls that the kernel supports to the drivers and to the user process, to the servers to get work done, and I'll mention those later. So it's not really a driver, but it's like the interface to the kernel calls, which are different from the POSIX system calls. They're completely different. We'll come to that in a minute. Anyway, above all of this, in user mode, are all the device drivers. So the disk driver is a process, the terminal driver is a process, the network driver is a process, the whole network stack is a series of processes. Printer driver, Ethernet driver, all these things are separate processes, each one running as a user process. None of them are super user. All of them are very restricted, as I will describe. Above that is a layer of servers. There's a file server, a process server, a reincarnation server, which is very important, and a bunch of other servers. Not so many, I don't know, a dozen or less than a dozen. And then on top of that are the regular user processes. From the kernel's point of view, all these things are just user processes. It doesn't really have a clear distinction, except for the fact that every process has a list of special powers, which for users is a very small list, and for kernel, for servers is a bigger list, and for drivers is a different list. So Every process individually has a list of special powers, but none of them are super user. Okay, so what does the kernel architecture look like? There is a notion of a process in the kernel. It's a very primitive notion. The inter-process communication uses the following calls, kernel calls. These are not visible to users. They're only to the system components. IPC request is like when a user sends a message to a file server saying read block or read piece of file. So there's a request from somebody to somebody else saying do work for me. And there's a reply saying work is done. You might say, why do you need two of them? It's important for the reliability that the kernel knows who's waiting for what in case something goes wrong. So if you do a request and there's no answer, the kernel knows, oh, he's waiting for him and he didn't answer. And there's a chance you can recover from that because the kernel has the information of who's waiting for what, okay? IPC select is kind of a general purpose receive where some process like a driver or a server can receive from other processes waiting for work requests to come in. And it can select from one or multiple sources. Notify is a way of getting rid of interrupts. Interrupts are a pain in the rear end. You want to get rid of them as fast as you can. So the very, very lowest level, an interrupt comes in, piece of code runs, it turns into a notification, which is a special kind of a message to whoever it's supposed to go to, typically a driver. And the way it's set is a bit is set in a bitmap saying something came in. Because you don't want to block the system if the driver isn't listening right now because you're doing something. So it sets a bit in a bitmap saying there was a message from you, a notification from the disk hardware. Okay? And this thing called IPC post, which is another call needed to handle the case where you send something to somebody and they're not listening, and they're dead, in fact. So it's a little bit complicated, but I won't go into that now. So an example of how this stuff works is a user over here sends an IPC request to a server, to the file server, read a piece of file. IPC request sends to the driver, go get the block. The driver does a reply to the file server saying, block gotten, and then the server goes to the user saying, okay, did you request? Okay. So here are some of the kernel calls we need. The kernel supports to the drivers and to the servers, but not to the users. One of the things that's very important is the drivers do not have access to the I.O. instructions. And they do not have access to the I.O. ports because you don't want a situation where an audio driver is mucking around with the disk ports because a bug in the audio driver can wipe out your disk. Now, on some hardware, you can actually map a very small set of I.O. ports into a specific process. If you can do that, then you're in business, but it's not very portable because other hardware can't do that. And so we simply said, let's not do it. But as an optimization on one architecture, you could use the hardware mapping if you could map I.O. ports one at a time. So there's a call to the kernel, which is, here's a list of I.O. ports, go read them. And it returns the value of the ports. Or here's a list of ports and values, go write them, and it writes them. There's a way to set the interrupt policies and set up interrupt vectors and so on. Because every driver and every server is running in their own address space, the file server can't copy data to the user because it doesn't have access to the user's address space. So it says to the kernel, go copy data over there. And we do this with capabilities. So if a user wants to do a read, it builds a capability saying, I hereby officially give permission to that file server over there to copy data from here to here in my address space. And it passes the capability to the file server, which now has permission to copy data to that piece of the address space and no more. So a buggy file server can write the wrong data into the buffer you asked it to, but it can't write data over other parts of the address space. And that's a kernel call, ver copy, which does this copying in a very limited, protected way. A whole model of paranoia. Don't trust anything. New map, defining new maps, and you create a process. The privileges are very important. I'll talk about those in a minute. Every process has certain powers and privileges, and you can set those under the right conditions. Get info allows you to read the process table out. But basically, this is another 30 or so of these calls. Very primitive calls that are used by the drivers and servers to get work done. The device drivers, as I said, all run in user mode except for the clock. They run as regular processes, nothing special. They're not super user. They all use this POLA. So every driver has exactly the powers that it needs, defined by some configuration file. This MMU protection is there, so the process can't touch memory outside its address space because the MMU is turned on and has mapped it onto whatever it's supposed to do. So they don't have access to the I.O. ports. They don't have access to privileged instructions. They can't muck around with any of the, kernel mode hardware, kernel mode instructions. They just do that which they've been given power by the kernel to do by some configuration time when the thing was started. User mode servers, well, there's a file server. You can have multiple file servers of different kinds, support different file systems. There's a process manager, which sort of manages processes. There's a data store, which is a little storage server for storing things somewhere else in case you need them. For example, for high reliability, you conceivably, we don't do this currently, but we're toying with the idea. The file server could checksum all the blocks in memory and write the checksums, cryptographic checksums, over to the data store. After a crash, if you restarted the file server, you don't know if the blocks are corrupted or not in the cache. You could re-checksum them and go ask the data store for the checksums, compare them, and if they're okay, then the blocks are valid. If they're not okay, the blocks are not valid. This gives you a way potentially to recover from even file server crashes by checking the validity of the block. You've got to store the checksum somewhere else, though. Okay? There's an information server, which has all kinds of useful things for helping you debug the system and keep track of things and find endpoints and whatnot. The network server runs entirely in user space. The TCP/IP server is another process. There's an X server, and there's a reincarnation server, which is really great. If you die, there you are again. I'll describe that again in a minute. Let me start with the file server. That's a simple one. I mean, it's not very complicated, and the logic is pretty straightforward. Here we have a user process. There's the file server. This little colored thing is like the file server's cache, the blocks that have been cached. Here's the disk driver. Here's that little system thing in the kernel which handles these kernel calls. Okay? So we start out when the user sends a message to the file system saying, read from file descriptor, 16, 4K. If it's in the file system's cache, which it will be often, the file system sends a message to the little system thing in the kernel saying, go copy this block from my memory to that piece of memory described by the descriptor this guy gave me. The kernel then takes the descriptor, checks to see if the descriptor says that file system has permission to copy here, what memory bounds are appropriate, and if everything's okay, the kernel does the little block copy from one space to the other. And then when it's all done, it tells the file system, okay, everything was okay, I did a copy, or error, you didn't have permission to do what you're trying to do, sorry, invalid. Then the file system tells the user, okay, we're done. And the message, we haven't really optimized very much. That's not been our focus. But the message passing takes about 500 nanoseconds on, generic PC. There's four messages here. So it takes 2 microseconds extra to do all this extra stuff. So we've added 2 microseconds. But the copying is sort of most of the time anyway. So the 2 microseconds is not a real killer. Okay, now let's look at a more complicated case where it wasn't in the cache. The same story. I'm going to put a disk over here now. The user sends a message to the file system. It says, read a block. File system says, oops, I don't have it in my cache. Send a message to the disk driver instructing it to go read, whatever block it needs. The disk driver sends a message to the kernel saying, okay, write these values on those I.O. ports, the values that cause the disk to do the proper activity. There's, half a dozen I.O. ports you have to activate. So it gives it a list of, write these values on these ports, bang. It writes them, it starts the disk. And then the system task tells the disk driver, okay, I wrote them. Eventually, you get an interrupt, which is turned into a message to the disk driver, which says, here's a message. I'm the hardware. Your operation is completed. The disk driver tells the file system, okay, operation is completed. The disk writes directly into the file system's memory, which has been protected by this capability. So the data, is only copied the same number of times it's copied in every system. The disk writes it directly into the file system's cache. And then the file system makes a call to the kernel saying, copy this block of data from my cache up into the user space, and then there's an answer saying, okay. And then the file system tells the user, okay, data copied, or, error. Okay? So that's sort of how it works. Now a little bit about the reincarnation server. The reincarnation server is the great mother of all processes and everything. It's sort of started by init early on, and it's the parent of all the drivers and the servers. They're all children of the reincarnation server. And so when a driver or a server dies, it's collected by its parent in the usual sort of Unix way, and that's the reincarnation server. So it says, oh, my poor child, the disk driver, seems to have died. Ooh, very bad. Okay? And it then checks a table to see, what am I supposed to do? There's probably some action supposed to take when a driver or a server dies. And in addition, the reincarnation server pings the various drivers and servers periodically. See, hi there, disk driver. I'm the reincarnation server. I'm mom. How are you doing? And the answer is supposed to say, mom, everything's wonderful. If it doesn't answer, then it gets pinged again. And after a certain number of pings when it doesn't answer, the reincarnation server assumes, this doesn't look good. So it kills it and starts a new one. So it's continuously checking on the health of the system. And of course, you can have a malicious driver which only answers the pings and does nothing else. But you know, we're not trying to, we'd like to, but it's very hard to make a system robust against malicious components that are actively trying to subvert the system. Okay? So how does disk driver recovery work, for example? I use disk driver because that's probably the most important driver. If it doesn't work, you're kind of hung. So the user sends a message to the file system saying, give me block, or read from a file. The file system sends a message to the disk driver saying, go read that block from that disk over there. And it crashes. Okay? Shouldn't happen, could happen. What happens is, the reincarnation server hears about that. Oh, my poor child, the disk driver has died. Looks up in his table what it's supposed to do. Chances are the action will require starting a new disk driver. All the drivers are kept on disk except for the disk driver, because we can't read a new disk driver from the disk if the disk isn't working. So the disk driver is shadowed in RAM. And once you have a working disk, you can read the rest of the drivers from the disk if you have to. Okay? So it starts a new driver. The file system gets a message saying, the other end of your endpoint just seems not to be there anymore. Sorry about that. The file system looks at what it was doing and says, oh, I was talking to the disk driver. Must have crashed. Okay, go ask the information server, is there a new disk driver? Finds out where the new disk driver is, what its endpoint is, and so on. Connects to it and says, hi, I'm the file server. Can you please read this block for me? And then it goes and does it. So the system is basically self-healing. Okay? And it's not, if the detail, yeah? You're dead. There is a certain amount of core stuff that has to work, but it's very small. Okay? We thought of having two reincarnation servers that check each other, but it gets out of hand. The reincarnation server is only about 10 pages of code. So 10 pages of code, you can probably get relatively bug-free over a period of time. It's pretty straightforward. That's a good question. Okay, so it's a self-healing system. That's, I think, a very important property. It can fix itself. It's checking itself all the time. When components fail, it goes out and tries to fix them. So here's a bit more on the mechanics of driver recovery. So when a driver exits, the reincarnation server gets a SIG child signal. One of its children has died, so it gets a signal. It says, oh, who was it? It's got a table, and the table says what it's supposed to do. So there's a policy set by the system administrator. It reads this in at boot time. What am I supposed to do when driver A fails, driver B fails, and so on. So it knows what actions to take, and that's all configurable. Typically, the policy is go run a shell script. That's the normal policy when a driver fails. It says, oh, I'm supposed to run, /etc/driver/script/disk driver. And that script will typically do something like save the core image somewhere in a safe directory so it can be debugged later so you can try to find out what happened, so save safely away. Okay? You probably want to make an entry in a log so the administrator knows that you've had a failure, something should be done. If you recover everything transparently, nobody knows what would ever happen. That's probably not a good thing either. So you want to log it so people can look at the log and see what's happening. You might want to send an email to the administrator saying, hey, we just had a failure in a recovery. The administrator is aware of it, possibly in real time, to take whatever action is needed. You still want to start a fresh copy of the driver. Most driver failures are transient errors. If the driver can't compute, the head sector track and so on from the LBA number or vice versa, probably won't get past the alpha testing. Most of the bugs that turn up are subtle timing bugs. If some weird condition happens, then you get into trouble. So the many cases, by restarting the thing, you sort of get out of the problem you're in. But you shouldn't want to log it, log the core dump and all that stuff, so later on somebody can look at it and try to figure out what happened, maybe fix the bug. It may fetch save states in a data store thing. So for example, we don't do this, but for example, if you've made calls to the audio driver to set the volume and diddle the bass and the treble, all that kind of stuff, it could easily send messages over to the data store to remember the IOCLs that you did. So when it comes back again, it goes to the data store and says, what commands have been issued to me, in this last incarnation of whatever, so it can rerun those and then set the bass and the treble back where they were and sort of get the world back in the state it was. Because that can be saved somewhere else, not in your address space. So if it goes down, it's safe somewhere else. Because if there's multiple failures simultaneously, you're hung. But most of the time, you get one at a time. A bit about the taxonomy of driver recovery. It turns into sort of, three categories, basically. The disks are actually very easy because they're idempotent. Because of the file system cache, either you're reading or writing. It's pretty much mostly what disks do. Formatting is a little bit special, but you're basically either reading or writing. If you're reading and you issue a command and it crashes and you're not sure whether it read it or not, it's an easy recovery. Just read it again. If you're writing, and you're not sure if it wrote it, you know, and it's in the file system cache, and the cache hasn't been mummed, but the driver died, the file system didn't die, it's an easy recovery. You just write it again. So disks are actually quite easy. You just repeat the operation. Okay? So if the file system says to the driver, do something, and it gets a message back saying driver died, it just finds where the new driver is, hooks up to him, and repeats the command. So that's very easy. So disks are really easy to do. Network drivers are even simpler. You just have to restart the thing. Now, if it was a TCP connection, TCP will recover. I mean, it's used to lost packets. It doesn't care whether the packet was lost because the network provider failed, or you know, some hub far away failed, or a packet got lost on your machine, or the Ethernet driver failed. It just knows when packets get lost, you time out and do it again. So that's easy. If it's UDP, there's no guarantee it's going to work anyway. So you've lost the packet. Well, UDP was designed so you know you lose packets, that's life. Nobody guaranteed anything. So that's easy. The character drivers are harder. You can't really transparently recover from character drivers quite as easily. The printer, it starts printing, and you're partway through printing, and it dies. You don't know, did it print that last page? Did it not print that last page? There's no way to find out. And so the best you can do is that the printer daemon will send a message to the printer driver, gets back a message from the kernel saying printer driver died. All it can do is go to the spooling directory and print the job again. That's the best you can do, because you don't know what actually happened. Likewise, if the audio driver dies, the best thing to do is play the song again. You know, it's really hard to tell what happened, and so on. So the character drivers are tricky, but typically the character drivers involve human interaction. And so, okay, the printer driver died, it'll print out 1.5 copies of your job. There's not much else you could do in an automatic way. Okay, device drivers and the Pola. Every driver and every server has very limited powers. And the key to fault tolerance and reliability is don't give every piece of code the power to do everything. A driver in the kernel is running in kernel mode. It can do anything it wants to. It can muck up the page table. It can muck up, you know, write an I/O port. As a user process, you can limit what it can do because everything it does has to require a kernel call. And the kernel call is going to check to see is it doing something it's allowed to do. So these are enforced by the kernel, and there's a very specific list of powers associated with every driver, which is set by configuration files time the driver is started, okay? You know, which kernel calls can it make? There's basically a 30 kernel calls. There's a bitmap, you know, with 30 bits in it. And every bit indicates which kernel call you can make. If you're allowed to fork, you know, for example, the process manager can fork because it's got to start new processes. The bit says, yes, you can fork. But if you're the printer driver, there's no reason you should be forking, so the bit is turned off. So the printer driver, either intentionally or accidentally, tries to fork. The kernel will send back a message saying, you know, invalid call. You're not authorized to fork. That limits what it can do in terms of kernel calls it shouldn't do. There's also a list of which processes it should be communicating with. You don't want the audio driver sending a message to the Ethernet driver if the Ethernet driver isn't expecting that, it's going to cause trouble. So there's a bitmap which says all the processes which are servers and drivers, who can you send to? Bitmap, and the kernel checks the bitmap, and if you're allowed to do it, you can do it. Otherwise, you get an error message back saying, oops, error. Which I/O ports you can touch. Again, the drivers don't have access to the I/O ports. They ask the kernel, here, write on these ports. Before the kernel writes on the ports, it checks. You know, if it's allowed, it does it. If it's not allowed, get an error message. So you can very tightly restrict things. Access to the user's address space is via these capabilities. So if the file system is trying to write to the user's address space, it has to have a capability for doing that. And if the user has built such a capability and given it to it, then it can write on the user's address space, but only in a certain limited part of memory, otherwise it can't. So all these things limit the power of these drivers to exactly what they need and no more. Of course, you have to get these configuration files right. That's true of every system. So as a net result of these things, what are the reliability properties? Well, first of all, fewer lines in the kernel means fewer bugs in the kernel. And kernel bugs are the worst of all, because a kernel bug can wipe out everything. Okay, so left, one bug per 1,000 lines of code. Less code, less bugs. That's life. I mean, someday maybe there'll be no bugs, but we're not there yet. There's no foreign code in the kernel. Very, very important. All of the kernel code are things like the interrupt handlers, the process scheduling, very, very core stuff that we are writing, or in the case of Linux, probably Linus is writing. I'm sure his code is extremely good. It's much, much better than the code that random people somewhere for a device driver company are writing. So we never put any foreign code in the kernel. It's all code written by the very best people. That really makes a difference. If somebody came to you and said, hey, will you put my foreign code in your kernel? You'd probably say no, and then they'd say, well, how about the FireWire drive? And you say yes. And so you don't want that. So there's no foreign code in the kernel. It's only code written by the core system developers. very important. The drivers are treated as untrusted, basically. You don't know where they came from. You don't know who wrote them. Statistically, we know that they're full of bugs. So you basically have to have the attitude drivers are untrustworthy, and they should be isolated. They should have limited power. You treat them as the enemy. Bugs and viruses and whatnot can't spread as easily because every piece has got MMU on and limits its own memory. It can't make random calls. It's all tightly limited. So things that do go wrong can't spread to other components easily. Okay? We restricted the power of these components because I'm not super user. This is Pola. And there's a list of which kernel calls you can make, who you can send to, which IO ports you can touch, all these things. Very specific in the data structure, basically, in the kernel saying what you can do. And the reincarnation server, when you load a driver, sets up that data structure to the exact powers that it needs. The drivers can't muck around with the kernel because they can't get at the kernel. So there's no danger it's going to override a kernel structure. There's no way to do it. A bad pointer or that kind of an error wipes out one component, but that's all. Even infinite loops can be detected to some extent. Nothing's looping, and the reincarnation says, hi there, disk driver, how you doing? And there's silence. Then, after three or four pings, it gets the answer, kills it, starts a new one. So to some extent, we can even catch infinite loops. And then, of course, again, in a malicious situation where the only thing it's doing is answering pings, we're hung. Other incidental advantages is because starting a driver is just, starting a user process, like starting, Firefox or LS or something, is a shorter development cycle. You've written a driver, compiled it, test it, to start running the driver. There's a more or less normal programming model. It's a regular user process, and printf works, and normal stuff all works. If it crashes, it's like a process crashing. It's a pity. They'll find the bug, fix it. There's no reboot, and it's much simpler and faster. The debugging is easier. Debuggers work sort of normally, and it's just a more flexible kind of model for the programmer because you're working in user mode. Okay. Now I'm going to tell you a story about the devil and the nerd. Watch out. The one on the left is the devil. Suppose the devil offers you a Faustian bargain. I will give you twice the speed and twice the crashes. Every nerd says, thank you, Mr. Devil. Thank you. You're a very kind devil. I accept. Normal users would never take that. They don't, never take that. Speed, was really important when you had 80 people running on a VAS, On one of these things or, desktop machine, speed isn't really very important anymore. I mean, in some applications like, big web server farms, it is. But for desktop machines, that isn't the issue, okay? Nevertheless, we've made some measurements on performance to see, how bad is it? Okay. Back in third grade, I learned that when you do scientific experiments, you change one parameter. Changing 50 parameters and measuring two things doesn't tell you very much. Okay? What I want to know is how much does putting drivers in user space cost in the way of performance? That's the datum I want. And so we made a bunch of measurements running various system calls. This is the, whoops. This is the call. This is what happens with the drivers in the kernel. This column is drivers in user mode. This is the difference in nanoseconds, and that's the ratio. And for getbid, it's 22% slower. Well, that's not surprising. All getbid does is take one integer and puts it in a register. So all this overhead is fairly substantial, when all you're doing is moving one number to a register. Lseek isn't quite as bad. It's only 11%. Opening and closing a file is 9%. Reading 64K is 8%. I don't know. On the average, it looks like between kernel mode drivers and user mode drivers, it's like 12% performance loss for this extra messages and copying. What about disk performance? We measured the reads and writes as a function of block size. And not surprisingly, if you're writing very large blocks, it doesn't make it, the 500 nanoseconds for the message doesn't matter very much when you're handling blocks that were, a couple of megabytes because all the time is spent copying. And in the case of 1K blocks, on a write, we lose about 18%, due to the extra overhead. But it's only 450 nanoseconds in real time. So there is definitely overhead, but it's not, minutes. We also looked at application performance. We made some measurements with the old system and the new system with the drivers in the kernel and drivers in user mode. And, for example, building minutes. That's 127 compiles. That's the kernel and the file system and the process manager and the reincarnation server and the terminal driver and the disk driver and, you know, the whole thing, not just the kernel. With user mode drivers on my machine, which is a 3.06 gigahertz PC, I can build all of Minix, the whole thing, in about 4 seconds. In a normal system, it takes about, 6 seconds. So 4 to 8 seconds, depending on the size of the PCs. Complete build. 127 compilations, 12 links. You know, I've never built Linux, so maybe you can build Linux in 2 seconds. But, you know, I can live with 5 or 6 seconds. It isn't that bad, even if you could theoretically do it in 3 seconds. Complete system built from scratch in 6 seconds. To me, that's fast enough, even though it's not the fastest there could be. We ran the POSIX test with an 8% loss. On the average, like 6%. People at, L4 people at, Karlsruhe or University of New South Wales, I forget. They made measurements of Linux versus L4 Linux. And they've tuned it much more carefully than we have. And they observed running some test suite on Linux versus an L4 Linux on top of a microkernel was like 5 to 10% loss. So our numbers are in the same ballpark. So if you do your best on performance, we're talking about maybe a 10% loss having this stuff running on this whole microkernel. So there is a performance loss, but it's not fatal if you, you know, do a good job. Another interesting experiment. Don't try this at home. We killed this Ethernet driver, which is the process. You can send a kill -9 to it to kill it. So we killed it periodically, wrote a script. It killed the driver every 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 6 seconds, and so on. See what happened. Okay. Well, what happened is, if you kill it every 2 seconds, the transfer goes slower. Okay. So normally we get about 11 megabytes a second out of our network, you know, driver. You kill the driver every 2 seconds, you only get 9 megabytes a second because it spends a lot of time recovering the driver. Nevertheless, the transfer occurs correctly without any loss of data. It just takes a little bit longer because you kill the driver every 2 seconds. You kill the driver every 10 seconds, now you've got, you know, 9.5 megabytes a second. So there's some performance loss. In actual operation, I would not expect the Ethernet driver to die every 10 seconds. But even if it does, we can recover transparently. The user doesn't see anything. The transfer works correctly, and there's some performance loss. So be it. The disk driver, same thing. We tried the same test. Under normal conditions, we get 33 megabytes a second out of the disk driver. If you kill it every 2 seconds, the performance drops to 20 megabytes a second. Just spend all your time recovering the disk driver. And if you kill it, you know, every 16 seconds, then we get maybe, you know, 28 megabytes a second out of it. So there's a performance loss of maybe 10 or 15% there. So it's consistent with the other numbers. Basically, all this recovery stuff costs you maybe 10% or 15%, something like that. Okay. Code size, these are the various components here over on the left. Oops. This is the number of files it is. This is how many lines of C, not counting comments and headers. This is the number of lines of assembler. Some people use semicolons as a metric of size. There's some linearity there. It's how big the binary is. And so, for example, for the kernel, this line, there's 45 files that make up the kernel. In total, it's 2,947 lines of C. That's undoubtedly obsolete by now, but we're talking that league. It's 800 lines of assembler for, you know, the very low-level interrupt handling and loading, you know, the MMU registers and that kind of stuff. And it's 21K. So the whole thing, including all the CRUD, is about 18,000 lines of C, 800 and some odd lines of assembly, say 20,000 lines of code, and it's about 173,000 bytes. That excludes, for some reason, I forgot to put in the network server, which is another 30,000 lines of code. So the whole thing is maybe 60,000 lines of code. Not all of which is critical. You know, the kernel is critical. Something goes there, you're dead. The reincarnation server, as somebody asked, is critical. The disk driver is not critical. The data store probably is critical because you're storing things in there. How many lines are critical? The file system at the moment is fairly critical, but the number of critical lines probably is 10,000. That's certainly an improvement over, you know, 3 million or something. Okay, almost done. We have a logo. Everybody else has got a logo. So our logo is a raccoon. Why a raccoon? Well, they're small. That's, you know, so big. They're kind of cute. They're very clever. Extremely clever. Good opening garbage cans and stuff. They eat bugs, which is very important. They're more likely to visit your house than a penguin, I think. However, that's only applicable in the northern hemisphere. Okay. So what's the positioning of Mannix? Well, why are we doing this? Well, we want to demonstrate you can build ultra-reliable systems. Okay. We want to demonstrate the drivers belong in user mode, and you know the performance hit is maybe 10-15%. You can do your best. There's certainly a lot of high reliability and fault tolerant applications. Yesterday there was a workshop here on microkernels, and I was amazed that you know guys from Green Hill Software and Pico West are talking about you know how their stuff is used in you know military aircraft, you know F-22s and F-16s, and ventilators at hospitals, and all kinds of things where if the software dies, people die. You know, and those applications, they all use microkernels. It really has to work. It cannot tolerate failure. So there are such things. I can imagine that we heard a talk yesterday on the $100 laptop. I think the next step beyond that is going to be the $50 single chip laptop. We put the CPU and the MMU and all the I/O gear and all of the RAM on one chip. Okay, and on such a system, you're going to be memory constrained because putting even 64 megabytes of RAM along with the CPU and the I/O gear and the MMU all on one chip is going to be a very big chip. But having such a chip allows you to reduce the price because the more chips, the more it costs. And so small footprint is important. We have a fairly small footprint, so that might be a potential application in the future. Embedded systems, they need powerful operating systems these days, but it has to be very reliable. You know, again, I've talked to Philips. They get very nervous when the stuff doesn't work. Their customers don't like spending $3,000 on a TV and getting a blue screen. They really hear about that, believe me. The customers don't like that. DVD players, cell phones, digital cameras, TVs, and so on. So that's the potential market of, small footprint, high reliability, fixes itself when something goes wrong. Conclusion. So I think current operating systems are bloated and unreliable. Linux is probably better than Windows, but I think there's room for improvement there. It's an attempt to build a secure, reliable operating system. I haven't talked much about security, but, we're also working on that. It's quite small. The kernel is only 3,800 lines of code. There's a fair chance, which in book form is about 80 pages. There's a fair chance that if enough people look at an 80-page program, they can eventually get most of the bugs out. It's actually understandable by a single person, okay? Because we're changing it daily right now because we're still developing it. But at some point, it's going to be stable and maybe, 5,000 lines of code. So the whole OS really runs as a bunch of processes. Each driver is a separate process. Each server is a separate process. They have very limited power. So everyone has got restricted power to only do the things it can do. If it tries to do anything else, the kernel will say, oh, sorry, can't do that. You can replace faulty drivers on the fly because they don't have a lot of state typically. The servers have more state, and it's a little bit trickier. We're working on that. As soon as you have a lot of state, you lose it, you lose the state, you're sunk. So the file server currently, it's hard to recover that, but we're looking at that. And I think most of all I've talked about in context of Linux, there's nothing here that can't be done in Linux. I mean, there's been work already on moving drivers to user mode. All these ideas are, you think of Windows, the USB driver stack has been moved to user space in Vista, and they're also starting to move it. So there's, maybe we're ahead of the curve here, but I think people are starting to move things into user space. I think all these ideas are equally applicable to future version of Linux. We have a website, minix3.org. It's got software and downloads and discussions going on. There's a CD-ROM in your bag, which is for an IDE CD-ROM. For technical reasons, if you have a notebook which has only got a USB CD-ROM, it won't work. You have to get the USB image from the website. Sorry about that. We've had, and people probably here don't follow it, but we've had over 500,000 visits to the website in the last year. It was actually quite interesting. We're currently running about 15,000 downloads a month. So there's a certain amount of interest out there. Commercial. TV programs are commercials. Radio stations are commercials. In Holland, movies are commercials, which is irritating. Japan, books are commercials. And now in Australia, scientific talks are commercials. We have a master's program in systems at my university. It's a 2-year program. It's focused entirely on systems. If you don't want any of this AI garbage or graphics or theory or any of that stuff, got rid of all of it. Focused entirely on systems, and you're looking for a master's program, you've got one. I also am looking for several postdocs in security, people who have a PhD looking for a job in security. For details, just ask Google for my homepage, and you'll find it, and the details are there. Also, probably good to see me today. And third thing is, it's not quite ready yet. We've also, another one of my little things is privacy. We've written this software called Turtle, which is privacy for file sharing communication. It's basically a peer-to-peer network, but also with friend-to-friend properties for like sort of Napster, but entirely encrypted and only friend-to-friend and all kinds of good properties to make it very private. So if you don't like the government spying on you, if you're a group of people, that's going to be out there in a couple of weeks. We tried to get it ready by today, but it didn't quite make it. But it's on turtle4privacy.com, so check it out in a couple of weeks. It should be there. So anyway, that's it. The URLs to note are minix3.org. And for the masters and the postdocs, just go to my homepage. You have to type my name to Google to find the homepage. And turtle4privacy.org in a few weeks. So, if any questions, I'm game. I take that back. Okay. You got one question. Yes, no, the question. Okay. Who else? What? All right.
You spent a lot of time talking about grandma. And I submit that there's a lot of evidence that grandma and the non-technical user community really like eye candy. That commercial software is bloated not because the vendors are silly or because people want faster computers by 3 microseconds, but because the users demand eye candy.
I don't think that the two are entirely incompatible. You can have, you know, a GUI with pretty little things and nice colors without having all these gazillion features underlying. I mean, having a pretty picture on your user interface doesn't require, you know, 50 megabytes of code to support it. It requires some kind of a graphical library. I'm not against graphical libraries. Oh, I didn't mention it, but last week we put an Equinox, you know, a graphical user interface to Minix, which is 200K instead of 200M, and it supports icons and simple menus and so on. And I don't think you need hundreds of megabytes of code just to have, you know, pretty pictures on the screen. So, yes, I'm for it, but I don't think it has to be so complicated to support it. Okay.
What's the license for Minix 3?
BSD. Free. Free software. Do whatever you want. Except one thing. You can't sue us. You know, we're not promising anything. Do whatever you want. Commercial, non-commercial, go for it. There's a certain amount of complexity, and I agree with that. But how does ptrace work? There's a ptrace system call, and that sort of works the usual way by going through the servers. So basically, you have to go through the server, you know, and if you authorize to do ptrace, which normally you will be, then ptrace, you know, calls the process server. And the process server, which has more power, can go read and write somebody else's memory. So the user calls the ptrace call. Ptrace goes to the process server, which has the authority to read somebody else's address space, and then it reads and gives it back to you and so on, or to write it. So it's the process server which has the power to muck around with other folks' address spaces, not the user. Okay.
So have you managed to tell Linus that he was wrong all those years, and did he believe you, or are you going to get somewhere in the... Sorry, should I repeat the question? Did you manage to convince Linus that he was wrong all these years and that he should do something different? But seriously, did you get...
Haven't tried.
More seriously, do you think that something can be done for Linux to make it more from your model? Or you don't want to answer that?
I don't want to get into the politics. We're trying to build a good technical system, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Do you have demand paging?
No, but we're going to add that. But we're going to think about it real carefully now. In the old days of the VAX with 80 users and 1 megabyte of memory, you know, all you did is page. Nowadays, that for reasonable applications, there's more memory than you need. And so paging is an exceptional condition. And so we're going to think of the, you know, Ben, my programmer, is going to start working on that as soon as 3.1.3 is out. But we're going to focus on what do you need in the way of paging now. And I think there's going to be shared libraries. The focus is going to be different, I think. So, yes, we're going to support demand paging, but more for sharing and things where that's relevant now if we're trying to run programs bigger than real memory. I don't think that, I mean, there's probably some games that need 40 gigabytes, but we're not going to cater to that. So yes, we're going to do it. No, we don't have it in there now.
So things like mmap of giant files for databases is kind of thing that might happen.
I mean, I said, we're going to add it, and it'll be there. And those applications that you know need it will have it. But our focus is not on that. We're not going to try to optimize the whole system for things where the virtual to real ratio is very large. Most of the time, you don't need it. So there may be some things where it doesn't work at all. So be it. You know, it should work, but it's not going to be optimized for that case. It's going to be optimized more for ordinary users who are running a browser and a word processor and that kind of stuff. It all fits in RAM all the time.
I can see how you handle the case of a driver actually dying or locking up. What about the more subtle bugs where a driver returns the wrong answer or the wrong data?
Yeah, there's no way to do that because you can't detect it. But in practice, I think most bugs in drivers where it's using the wrong algorithm tend to get detected at the time the manufacturer of the drive tends to find the gross errors more quickly. If it can't figure out where the disk is, you hear about that. It's the weird timing bugs that are the ones that are hard to find. So yes, if some component is using the wrong algorithm, we can't detect it. Nobody can detect it. So that's impossible. Best we can do is start it again and see if it can get out of the mess it got itself into. So yes, if the component is algorithmically wrong, we can't detect it, you can't detect it, nobody can detect it. That's life. But at least we can detect the ones where it hung itself because two things happened at the same time.
Drivers are treated as untrusted in this model. How do you resolve the issue that driver authors must nominate what privileges are allowed?
This is a configuration file, and it's true that there's an issue on that. But if it's your system, ultimately, I suppose, you get to change the configuration files. And I mean, we haven't got an installer and so on, but presumably when you install something, it would say, and I need the ability to write to the network, and I need the ability to blah, blah, blah. And you could have some dialogue where you will check boxes, for example, where you say the audio driver needs to read from the network. Sounds plausible. Maybe it wants to read music from somewhere. But the printer wants to write to the network. Wait a minute now. Do you want that? Yes, I have a remote printer. Okay. Or no, I don't have it. So ultimately, the user of the system or the system administrator, presumably at a time the driver is sort of configured or installed in the system, would have some way of setting which powers you want. Since they're all very finite, you can have a dialog box with little check marks saying yes, this, no, that. But we haven't got that far. But the mechanism for that is there. And how you actually do it is a question of what kind of a GUI you want and so on. But there's a procedure for it.
Thank you very much, Andy, for coming here and whipping the kids into shape. I'm sure that Linus and Rasmus, in particular, were listening attentively. I mentioned on Monday that we had one correct hat, and it is, in fact, a gift for Andy. We've corrected it for you. And we have two of our, unfortunately, uncorrected linux.conf.au glasses. The hat is for minix.conf.au. Thank you, everyone. It's now morning tea. Rock on. Have an awesome day.